My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so blessed to be here, and I'm so grateful. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me.
Just a little bit. There you go.
Thank you, Mark, for inviting me. And Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Welcome to the newcomers. Welcome to Jennifer, I think, and anybody else that's here new. My sobriety date is July 11th, 2006. My home group is the Live and Let Live group, the Thursday night Live and Let Live group in Tehachapi. I do have a sponsor. I talk to him frequently, and I work with other men as often as I can. When anyone reaches out for help, you know, I want the hand of AA to be there. I loved drinking, you know. I absolutely loved drinking. I drank to excess. I never did drink normally. And my first drink that I remember, and I wasn't consciously going out to take a drink. I must have been knee-high. I was probably like 3 or 4. This was my first memory, and it was some sort of celebration. I can't recall what it was, a holiday or something, and I don't remember who it was, but they gave me a drink, and I thought it was juice, right? And I remember drinking it, and I immediately wanted more, and they laughed. You know, this was the early 80s, you know, when you would give your kids beer, right? Or whatever it was. And they laughed, and they wouldn't give me any more, and I cried, you know? And you know, that for, I don't know why, but that was my very first memory that, like, stuck in my mind. And I believe that I was an alcoholic from the very gate. And I believe that I had that phenomenon of craving at this tall, you know. And of course, I had no idea that's what it was. But, you know, I didn't have a drink for quite some time after that. You know, I wasn't an everyday drinker at 3. But I never could take a drink without developing the phenomenon of craving. I never could. I grew up in Tehachapi. Which is a great town to grow up in. You know, I loved it. I had a good family. My mom was a nurse. My dad was a firefighter. I had 3 older sisters. I was the youngest of 3, the only boy. I was the spoiled brat, right? And it was good. Like there's no real abuse. Like I can't really complain about anything. Like I grew up in a very loving family, and I'm very blessed for that. I know that's not everybody's story, but I can't blame my alcoholism on that at all, you know. And when I was about my first drink, I was about 10, and right before this, like I said, my dad was a firefighter, and he was working out in Randsburg, Station 75, and a Carlo Rossi truck jackknifed on the 395, and it was a total loss. And the truck driver told my dad that insurance was going to be paying for the whole load, and all unbroken bottles he could have. And he loaded up his patrol truck with Carlo Rossi, gallons of Carlo Rossi. And my dad was my dad's normal, right? My dad opened up one of those bottles of Carlo Rossi, took a drink, and didn't drink any more of it ever again, you know, because it's nasty stuff. You know, it's $5 a gallon, right? So there were gallons of Carlo Rossi in my garage, and I remember my first drink after I was about 3, right? When I was about 9 or 10, we went camping. I love camping too, right? We're camping, we're out in the Sequoia, and that Carlo Rossi was there, and I had a solo cup, my first drink, a solo cup, half Carlo Rossi, half Shasta Cola, right? And so I was high shelf from the gate, you know. And it's the typical description that I hear a lot of alcoholics share, you know, that warmth, that feeling of like ease and comfort, right? And I remember the flames were more majestic, right? It was warmer. I was laughing. And I had like 3-4 of those Carlo Rossi Shastas, right? And I don't remember getting back to my tent. You know, I must have blacked out. I woke up in my tent the next morning. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I pretty much became a wine. I drank all of those gallons of bottle of wine, every single one. I'd sneak them out into the goalie, you know, later on when I was 12, 13. I start sneaking those bottles out and hiding them in the goalie behind the house and sneaking out and walking down to my friend's house with a gallon of wine, and we'd share a gallon of wine, you know. So I became a wino pretty young, you know. I'm a Skid Row variety drunk. I never really amounted to a whole lot drinking, because I didn't really want to. I wanted nothing more than to drink more. I just needed another drink, and it started to become a problem. I was in seventh grade. I got suspended from school for being drunk at a dance, and I stole a bottle of melon liqueur. It was this green ball. It was nasty stuff. And I remember giving it to my friend Larry, and he took a drink and was like, ew. And I drank it. I didn't want it to go to waste. And I got suspended. You know, they called my grandmother up to come pick me up. And you know, I started going to juvenile hall for stupid things, and I started to get into trouble. And it just got worse, you know. It slowly got worse, but it was still working for me, right? It was a party. I loved it. When I drank, I still got that feeling, right? The flames would get majestic. I would get that warmth and ease and comfort. Like, I would drink, and it worked. My freshman year in high school, it started to be, like I said, it started to get worse. 14 years old, I ended up that year a couple times in the emergency department. One time it was a 0.418. I drank two or three fifths and got picked up. And actually, you know, what happened is my dad was a firefighter, and like I said, and he was the assistant chief for the volunteer fire department in Tehachapi. And he always had a dispatch radio on him. And he heard a call go out. I was a runaway. And he had a call go out, and it was an overdose, a seizing patient, and he was the first to show up, and it was me, and I was seizing, foaming out of the mouth, and I was told, obviously I have no recollection of this, but I was told that when the ambulance and his brothers, the other firefighters, got there, he was holding me, crying, and of course that meant nothing to me. You know, and I put my family through that over and over and over through the next 12 years. But that year, I multiple times in the emergency department, I ended up getting expelled from high school for various alcoholism related things, to say the least. And it was toward the end of the year, and the consequences was that I was grounded. And I don't know if you're anything like me, but like I needed a drink. And being confined to my bedroom wasn't going to work, you know? So I started running away. And I wasn't the typical runaway. Some of my friends would run away. They'd pack a backpack, go across town to a friend's house until they were caught, and then they'd go home. And I started hopping freight trains, and they'd start finding me states away. And for the most part of the next 12 years, I lived on the street. And like I said, I'm a Skid Row variety drunk. And it didn't get a whole lot better, you know, but it was still working, right? And I started getting arrested, you know, more frequently. I was a runaway. I was going to tour the Grateful Dead. That was my plan. And I got into a couple shows, but I was mostly just drunk and loaded in the parking lot, you know, and I was fine with that. I was okay with that. Jerry Garcia died a year after that. It was like 1995, and I ended up going pretty kind of punk rock, so I thought, you know, and I was like punk rock skater, right? And you know, I slept in bushes, you know, I was up in the Pacific Northwest, and things just continued to get worse. I was 17. I was 17. I like to share this because I think it's funny, you know, and it's kind of the epitome of the delusion, right? I was 17. I was under a bridge in Seattle, Washington, and I was barbecuing a stolen steak on the side of a shopping cart with a gallon of Carlo Rossi, thinking, I have got it made. You know, I have got, you know. And that was the best it got, you know, a stolen steak and a bottle of Carlo Rossi. And you know, I used to say I got extradited back to California, but when you're getting extradited, that means you have to go face, you know, you have to go to take care of another case in another state. And, you know, thinking about it, I didn't get extradited. They deported me from the state of Washington. I got arrested in Seattle, and they put me on an airplane and sent me home. But what they didn't know is that I had panhandled about $100 right before that. So when I got home, I ended up going straight back to Seattle within a couple days. But yeah, it got worse. I got 17. I was hitchhiking out of Pasadena. Got hit by a diesel truck. Broke my leg. You know. A week later, I got hit by a fast-moving trolley car and broke my arm. No, but it got worse. You know, a week after I turned 18, I was facing 13 years on a grand theft auto, felony, DUI, et cetera. And you know, and I thought it was a joke. Somehow, I pled that down to misdemeanors and I got a 90-day sentence. You know, facing 13 years, I somehow pled that down to a 90. And I couldn't stay out of county jail after that. You know, that year I spent 11 months in county jail on multiple different misdemeanors, you know, public intoxications and petty thefts and stupid minor things. And I get out of jail, and within a week, within a couple days, within a couple weeks, you know, I'd be back in county jail. And there's a few of those times I remember vowing never to drink again. I am never going to drink. And I meant it. I'm never going to drink again. And it'd be like 90 days. I'd 90 days without a drink. I'm never going to drink again. And I'd get out and I'd have that county check. And they would put me on the county van, bring me to the Greyhound station. And the Greyhound station knew that check was good. So they'd cash it. And my leg, my head would be like, don't, no. And my legs would start walking, you know. And I'd be drunk, you know, within a few blocks, you know, I would be drunk. And I just could not drink. You know, stepping back a little bit, when I was 14, after getting out of the emergency department and all of those things, my friend's mom saw that I had a problem. And she brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember going in, and I remember sitting there and kind of thinking, this is lame, you know, this is stupid, and I just wanted another drink. But a seed was planted, you know. However small that seed was, it was planted. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 14 years old. And then I ended up going to a lot of different meetings, you know, when I was younger in the Pacific Northwest to get out of the rain, to get a hot cup of coffee. And I ended up going to some meetings in county jail, H&I coming through. And, you know, the last time I went to jail in Kern County, I remember I got a public intoxication, and I was like 30, 60, 90 days, whatever it's going to be. And the judge was like, I knew your grandfather, and if he was still alive, he'd kick your ass, right? And that's what he told me. And he gave me 180 days for that public intoxication. I was like, oh my gosh, you know. So I was like, 180 days for a public intoxication. I was like, dang. So he was sick of seeing me. So I decided that I would start going to jail. I was going to start going to jail somewhere else, you know. And, And I ended up in the Pacific Northwest, and they didn't. They had a lot of budget cuts, and they couldn't prosecute misdemeanors, so they'd pick you up. So I was like, free beer, right? And they'd pick you up and just put you in a drunk tank and kick you out the next day. And I've lost count how many times I've been arrested. I guess 50 times, you know. But it got worse, you know. It got worse, you know. I was 21, barely legal to drink, and it started to get real dark. You know, and there were years that I can't really recall, but I do remember I was 21. I was in Portland. I was in Laurelhurst Park. I used to love to drink in that park. I generally like to live in parks. You know, I sleep in bushes, and I was in that park, and I was really drunk, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And I was on my second or third, fifth, who knows how many beers and wine I had been drinking, and I can't do this anymore. And luckily, I was too drunk to be successful. But I put my belt around my neck, and I hoisted myself up over a branch, and until I passed out, and I'd come to, and I'd curse God, and I'd take a drink, and I'd try again, and I did that two or three times before I just decided to finish the bottle. And I drank like that for the next 5 years, pretty much day in and day out. I can't stand it. I tried to portray that it was a party still, that this was punk rock and it was a party, and I just tried to pretend that it. But inside, I couldn't stand it anymore. But there was no escape. You know, this was my lot in life. I'm just gonna have to take it to the bitter end. But I was 21. Shortly after that, I ended up in another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat down, and there's this girl sitting on this side of me, all in leather with a purple mohawk. And on this side of me, there's this old crusty man, you know. And I remember looking at both of them going, I'm not like these people. And I continued to drink. And like I said, I drank like that for the next 5 years, trying to pretend it was a party, trying to pretend it was a party, and trying to have as much fun as I possibly could. Well, I took this to the bitter end. You know, I would pray that God would just end it, and I drank. God help. This is how I would pray. God help me. You know, and I would drink, never willing to do anything about it. And, you know, God put the right people in my place. Thousands of prayers. You know, I couldn't understand why God, being all powerful, you know, why was I going to die in the gutter? And faith without works is dead. And I had no hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is great. You know, I could intellectually understand spiritual principle, why I should be honest and forgiving and loving and kind, and you know, I could understand why that was good, but I just had no way to practically apply that in my life. And you know, I was at a bar, I was drinking, and funny thing is the DJ had 11 years of sobriety, and in a roundabout way, she said, "Joe, if only you were sober." And I remember thinking, I said, you know, well, I've already started drinking today, so tomorrow I'm not going to drink, and tomorrow I'm going to go to a meeting. And for some reason, I meant it. Like, for some reason, I had gotten to this point where I was like, tomorrow I'm not drinking, I'm going to a meeting. And I did, and I the next day I went to a meeting. I didn't drink. I went to a meeting. It was Saturday, and I felt good. And I went to another meeting the next day, and another meeting. You know, I went to meeting after meeting after meeting, and you know, I was a week sober, and it was the Tuesday speaker meeting in Tehachapi. I was a week sober, a little over a week. And Jenny kind of scared me a little bit, you know. And Jenny came up to me and she's like, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "I think you should ask him to be your sponsor." I was like, "Okay." She's like, "At the break, go ask him to be your sponsor. And I was like, okay, I'll do that, sure. You know, just trying to get Ginny away from me, you know. And after the meeting, she asked me again, you know, did you go ask him to be your sponsor? And I was like, no, but I'm thinking about it, you know. And Ginny saved my life, you know. Ginny grabbed me by the hand. Another person, that just the right person I needed in my life, you know. Ginny was there, you know, and she grabbed me by the hand like a child, you know. And because she knew I was terrified, and she knew that I couldn't. And she walked me up to him, and introduced us and walked away. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And I knew that I should say yes, so I said yes. And, you know, that same meeting, Ginny also railroaded me into my first commitment, you know, vacuuming after the Tuesday night meeting. And I remember I was irritated. I remember thinking, you know, if vacuuming was going to get me sober, you know, I would have bought a vacuum a long time ago, you know. This is kind of lame, you know. And I'm, like, irritated vacuuming, like, you know, how is this going to help me? And a week later, you know, I'm vacuuming, still a little irritated. And I remember it was 3 weeks after that. It was the third time, and I had this sense of peace. I was vacuuming, and I wasn't thinking about how annoying it was. I was just vacuuming, and I had this sense of peace. And it hit me real strongly that, you know, thank God I had been wrong. Because I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was a joke. I thought that this couldn't work for me. I thought you all were fools. You know, I thought that this was silly, that I was going to have to just take this to the bitter end. And I was sitting there vacuuming, and I was like, oh my God, this is real. This is real. And I hadn't been doing a whole lot. You know, I had been hanging out with my sponsor a little bit, and we were reading and, you know, doing my first step, and I started to feel like something was happening. You know, and I kept vacuuming after that Tuesday night speaker meeting. And, you know, I kept meeting with my sponsor, and he took me through the steps, and I started to learn a little bit more about honesty, and I started to look at myself. And, you know, I remember he would say to me over and over, you know, half measures availed us nothing. The result was nil until we let go absolutely. I don't remember. Maybe he only said that to me twice, but in my mind, he said that to me 1,000 times, you know. And I was about almost 90 days without a drink, and I was going to take my 90-day chip, and I couldn't because I hadn't been completely honest. You know, I was taking half measures, But what happened is that day, or the day before, I called him. We worked a third step, and it was the most awkward feeling, and it was quite foreign, you know, getting on my knees and holding another man's hands and saying that third step prayer. But I did that, you know, and we said that third step prayer together, and I went home, and I was like, I'm going to drink, you know, because I was taking half measures. And the result was nil. And I knew that I was going to drink. And it scared me. It scared me because I absolutely didn't want to drink. The obsession to drink was gone. But I knew that if I continued down the way I was going, that I was going to drink. So I called him the next day, and I told him. And this was so powerful to me because, you know, I was so used to getting 86th and you're an idiot and all of these things that I was just expecting that, and I called him up, and I said, I can't take my 90-day chip. And he said, what's going on? And I told him what was going on, and he said, you're right where you're supposed to be. You know, all you have to do is change your sobriety date, and we're going to continue where we're at. And I love you. And And it was like this sense of relief, you know, and I've been clean and sober ever since, you know, that then, you know, July 11th, 2006. And that next day, you know, I started my fourth step. And, you know, and I was still oblivious. I was oblivious to the process. I was full flight from reality. You know, I was crazy. And you know, so I'm writing down this resentment list, and I'm thinking, this is why I drink. You know, it's this person's fault and this person's fault. I had, you know, I was writing this down like, yes, you know. You know, my mom, you know, the highway patrol, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, writing down all these resentments. And you know, I got to that, you know, the resentments, the fears list. I did that sex inventory to the best of my ability that first time, you know, and you know, we went to do my fifth step, and I continued down that. I was like, you know, oh, this is why I am, you know, and he asked me, you know, what so many sponsors, practically every sponsor asks, right? What part did you play? And I remember thinking, oh, no, you know, because I was like, oh, because I was oblivious. Like, and it caught me off guard. What part did you play? I was like, oh. And I had, I had like 60, 70 resentments. I was like, I shouldn't have been so thorough, you know. I shouldn't have been so thorough. But, you know, but it was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, and it hit me what was really going on and what this was about. I had dodged responsibility my whole life. You know, I thought that the least amount of responsibility I had, the freer I'd be. Like, if I didn't have to answer to anybody, then I would be free, right? I didn't have a license, no insurance, no registration, didn't have a job, didn't have a house. I lived in a bush, right? And so, like, I thought that if I had nothing, I would be free. And I come to discover that I was more bound then than ever before, and I got to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that the more responsibility I take, the freer I become, you know, and I started to take responsibility, and, you know, I started to look at my character defects and shortcomings, and, you know, humbly offering myself to God, and, you know, becoming willing to make amends, and I started that process. I started to make amends. And, you know, those promises started to come true. And the man, the peace I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I don't deserve this, you know, like, but here I am, you know. I should have drank myself to death. I was planning on drinking myself to death. And the freedom that I have gotten from through taking the steps is worth more than anything I could have imagined, you know. And, you know, and I try to continue to do that. You know, I try to continue to do that. You know, like a tenth step, you know, I try to continue to look at myself honestly. And I need help. You know, I can still be delusional. And I could still be full flight from reality, and I could still do some stupid things, you know, and that's why it's so important to be in a lot of meetings and to be in contact with my sponsor and other men. And, you know, but I try to admit when I'm wrong promptly, and I try to make things right where I can, you know. And the 11th step, you know, there's so many different ways. You know, I don't know, just thinking about coming here today, I had prayed a lot, you know. It's like, oh, God grant me the serenity, right? But I love it. You know, prayer has never failed me. It has never failed me. When I, you know, I will be driving, and it's a meditation at the same time for me. But I'll go through a third step, a seventh step, you know, the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. I'll do the serenity prayer, the Lord's prayer, the set-aside prayer, right? And I get this sense of peace, right? And then meditation can go in so many different directions, right? I love just breathing, right? I love being outside and enjoying. And I just, you know, I love the 11th step, you know, and trying to improve my conscious relationship with a power greater than myself. And I, And then the 12th step, continuing the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening. I believe I've had a psychic change. I believe I've had a spiritual awakening. And because I'm a different person today. Now, don't get me wrong. If I go out there and take a drink, we all know what'll happen. I will be in a bush quicker than you know it, I'll be gallon bottle of wine, with a broken skateboard probably. And cursing God, and I never want to go there again. And, trying to be of service, and trying to carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer. And the message is, that recovery is real. We do recover. I should be dead, and I was, and I said yes, I did what was suggested, and my life changed. My life transformed. It's crazy. Like I was sharing earlier, I got kicked out of high school. High school dropout. I had been arrested who knows how many times. I guess 50 times I've been arrested. Kern County alone, I had 11 convictions. I 5150'd multiple times. I actually did get a GED from Laredo County Jail. I'm a Laredo County graduate. And, I had been living on the street for over a decade for the most part. And I find myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, learning how to do these. I'd look on the wall, first things first, easy does it, live and let live, let go and let God. And I'm like, I think, how lame initially. And then the longer I'm here, I'm like, how true, right? And I started to practice those things, And Alcoholics Anonymous has removed my excuses. One excuse at a time, Alcoholics Anonymous is like, nope, you can't have that excuse anymore. And I was sitting in a meeting in Tehachapi, and I was like, I want to go back to school. I think I'm going to go back to school and take some classes. And it was this guy named Pete. He's like, well, you should go down to Bakersfield Community College, go sit down, take the placement exam, see where you're at, and start taking some classes. I was like, okay, kind of like Jenny. Okay, Jenny, sure, yeah, I'll do that at the break. Yeah, Pete, I'll do that, sure, yeah, we're going to do that. And the next week, I want to go back to school. And Pete was like, so did you go down to the college and take any of those placement exams? No, but I'm going to, I'm thinking about it. And it was another week goes by, and he's, no, I just didn't have enough gas. Making excuses. And Pete, oh man, thank God he did this. He said, you didn't have enough gas. How much does it cost to get to Bakersfield, Joe? And I was like, oh no, oh no. Started pulling money out of his wallet, How much does it cost, Joe? I was like, oh crap, $10. Here's $10, Joe. Drive to the college. So I did that, And one day at a time, I took one class at a time, one assignment at a time. And, I ended up getting an associate degree in human biology, right? And I was like, yes. And, one day at a time, one court case at a time, one paper at a time, I served the courts, I served the district attorney and probation and I got all of those convictions expunged, one day at a time, one case at a time. And I ended up, and I was like, I decided I was doing cabinetry for another member in Alcoholics Anonymous, working with him, and I was like, I want to be a nurse. I don't know why. My mom was a nurse. It was mostly because I was like, job security, right? It's going to be a good job. But, growing up, I was never like, what do you want to be when you grow up, Joe? I want to be a nurse. That wasn't the case. But I decided to do that. And, I went back to school, and I got my nursing degree. And I didn't realize that when you get expunged at the local level can't see anything. But when you're applying for state licensure, it's a federal background check, and that is not expunged, right? So I had to do a full disclosure, and the California Board of Registered Nursing denied me licensure. And I was kind of devastated because I graduated at the top of my class, and the California Board of Registered Nursing shot me down. And I, one day at a time, you know, I walked through that, and it took me 27 months fighting the California Board of Registered Nursing before they allowed me to sit for my boards. And I remember at one point I wanted to give up so many times, and I just had to get back to this place where it was like making a decision to turn my will and my life out of the care of God. You know, I got to this place where I was like, God, whatever your will is for me. If your will is for me to go this way, have me go that way. If your will is for me to go that way, have me go that way. But I don't know what your will is, so I'm going to keep walking forward, and I trust you'll guide me in the right direction, right? And I made it through that. And I wanted to be a travel nurse. I became a travel nurse. I wanted to be a flight nurse. I became a flight nurse. Ended up going back to school for my Bachelor of Science. And in 3 days, I'm going to be graduating with my master's degree, you know. And the only reason why I say that is because if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous can transform your life. Like, I am a Skid Row variety drunk. I'm a wino. I would have drank myself to death in the gutter. And today I could live a life that, as they say, beyond my wildest dreams. It's true. Like, I go to sleep with peace. And all of that really doesn't matter. I mean, that might not necessarily need to be your story. You could decide to do whatever you want, you know. There's this guy in AA and THB, Bart, and he would say it often, you know. If you're willing to make the sacrifice and do the footwork, you could do anything you want. And I remember hearing that going, you know, and it was true. So if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, stick around, get a sponsor, take the steps, go to a lot of meetings, get a commitment, and I believe that you can recover from alcoholism. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is one of the coolest things. At the top of that list, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of great things in Alcoholics Anonymous, but at the top of that resentment list was my mom. And my mom was, at one point in time, she wasn't the nicest person, to say the least. And I got very resentful, and there was a lot of excuses to drink. I use that as an excuse to drink. And I hated her, absolutely hated her. And she was at the top of that resentment list. And by the time I had gotten to my ninth step, I had learned that a little bit about taking responsibility and cleaning my side of the street. And I went to make amends to her. And I mentioned, you know, and I cleared my side of the street, right? And today, that is one of my most cherished relationships. I go on walks with my mom every week, sometimes a couple times a week. We had lunch. Yesterday was my birthday. You know, I went and had lunch with her. And, you know, I love that woman. You know, and if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, that relationship would have been destroyed. It was irreparable. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to have that relationship with her. You know, my dad still has that radio, right? He's been retired for years. And he still is a firefighter, right? And he listens to that dispatch. He does not worry it's going to be me anymore. And I could never repay Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely could not repay Alcoholics Anonymous. 20 years ago, I never thought that this is where I'd want to be on a Friday night in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's no place I'd rather be. There's no place I would rather be. I have 2 minutes left, but I've run out of things to say.